Just a reminder, the content of this show is for informational purposes only. Please visit blockstack.org/legal/disclaimers for more info. Hi there, and welcome to the Stacks Podcast. I'm Zach Valenti. Today's episode features a discussion between Nick Carter, partner at Castle Island Ventures and co-founder of the blockchain analytics platform Coinmetrics, Jude Nelson, an engineering partner at Blockstack, and Patrick Stanley, Blockstack's head of growth. The three dig into the opportunities and challenges of crypto, in particular, the problem of incentivizing development and measuring progress on crypto networks early on. Now, here's Nick, Jude, and Patrick.
Nick, Jude, thanks for joining the podcast. Nick, do you want to give us a little bit of background on yourself? And then Jude, who's also on the Blockstack team, can give his own background.
Sure. And thank you for having me. I really appreciate it. So quick background on me. I'm a partner at a venture firm called Castle Island Ventures. And I am one of the original co-founders of a project and now startup called Coinmetrics, which is devoted to blockchain analytics. So I have two things that I do.
Cool. And Jude, what's your background?
Hey, I'm an engineering partner at Blockstack. I primarily work on the blockchain itself, which includes the consensus protocol, the peer network, replication, everything that sits behind the RESTful interface, more or less.
Cool. Great having you both on. Kind of leading up to this podcast, we were discussing some topics and you brought up this idea of proof of reserves. Wanted to know kind of what your thoughts are on that and what the sort of state things are there.
Totally. Yeah. So it's kind of a hot topic right now. I'm on sort of a one-man quest to get exchanges to institute proofs of reserves, albeit with no success so far. So perhaps this will move the needle a little bit. The idea is that exchanges are not just used as exchanges on, you know, they're not just used on a pass-through basis by users. People actually custody their funds with them. And that's all well and good, but most of these exchanges are lightly or non-regulated. And if we want to portray ourselves as a superior or a functional alternative to the current financial system, we should also behave commensurately and, you know, pass on, you know, genuine assurances to depositors. So what I'm suggesting is that exchanges revive this concept of proofs of reserves and, you know, prove to their depositors that they actually have the funds that they say they have. And this is actually not that radical of an idea. I mean, a lot of exchanges created these proofs or attestations back in 2014 after Mt. Gox, and they subsequently stopped doing it. So now in the wake of Quadriga and the Bitfinex crisis that continues to rumble on, I am suggesting and hoping that exchanges will realize that they actually have a duty to be much more transparent to their depositors and provide these sorts of proofs.
What headwinds are you most meeting? Are you making contact with the exchanges and they're just outright saying no, or are you just met with silence?
No, I mean, I don't exactly have the time to actually meet directly with exchanges and ask the day. This is just more of a hobby. This is me being loud. But yeah, I have been contacted by a few exchanges that are sympathetic to the cause, you know, including CoinFloor, who do this. So they've created a proof of reserve for 60 months running. And they're a pretty small exchange based in the UK. And so if they can do it, honestly, anybody can do it. It's technically not that challenging to create a proof of reserve. So there's really no excuse for any of these major exchanges.
Yeah, that's fair. I think we're kind of seeing similar things in the sort of dApp space where you have these dApp stores that are effectively ranking applications based on the transaction throughput and volume. The fact is some of these quote unquote blockchains provide free transactions. What's happening is, you know, people who are curators for the apps are effectively running transactions through from wallet to wallet to sort of simulate activity. And so there's like a ton of noise in the system. My sort of beef with that is it doesn't allow real signal to appear in the market. And it doesn't allow for things like genuine investors to, you know, be able to evaluate these new apps that are really kind of pioneering new business models to enter into the market and actually give it the sort of real sustenance they need. Aside from that, I think it's just like morally wrong to mislead people essentially on the activity of the applications.
That's fascinating. We actually have this precise problem at Coinmetrics because the objective over there is to ascertain what the real level of economic usage of a given blockchain is. We haven't quite delved into the at the dApp layer yet, but this is a problem on a macro basis. So you have these blockchains where transactions are free or like they make significant centralization trade-offs in exchange for more scalability or throughput or something. And everybody knows that investors look at the ranking sites that track the on-chain usage. So the objective then becomes to game the rankings and create a semblance of vibrancy. So this is, I'm not going to name names exactly, but this is absolutely the case, both at the dApp level and at kind of the macro like transactional level too. And I'm not actually sure what the solution is. I mean, you can be quite opinionated about it as a data provider. And certainly many of the data providers are a little bit lackadaisical when it comes to screening out this kind of usage. But yeah, I haven't found a good solution so far. I mean, there's a law about this. I think the law is something like when a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure, a Goodhart's law. So if something is valuable and is a driver of value, that metric then becomes targeted. So this is sort of an eternal problem in blockchains and something that's sort of underreported, I think.
Yeah, my sense is that the dApp stores that continue to participate in a Red Queen's race, which in my opinion, they've set up themselves by ranking the apps that way, as opposed to, say, taking in multiple different levels of information and creating their own proprietary ranking. They're going to be the ones that people don't trust, and people are going to, there's going to be a flight to sort of a more proprietary mix. People are getting higher signal on both the consumer level and the investor level. Jude, do you have any, just like quick side street, do you have any opinion on the trade-offs for free transactions in the long term and why essentially like a crypto network would not want to bias their network in that way?
So before I answer that, there's no such thing as a free transaction. Somebody's going to pay for the space of holding that state and validating the transaction itself. It's just that for certain platforms, the architecture is such that the user doesn't see that cost up front, but somebody such as the developer or the entire network is still going to have to pay for it. So what I suspect is going on with some of these platforms is they're just biting the bullet right now to at least make it look like there's activity on their platform with the hope that as if they fake it, they will make it down the road. Insofar as the other part of your question, can you just repeat it quickly?
You're an architect, essentially. You're a distributed systems PhD who sort of builds these things for a living. I'm trying to get a sense of like, what is the trade-off? You're biasing yourself to quote unquote free transactions. Let's just call it that for the sake of argument. You lose other aspects, right? And so sort of long-term thinking, why would you kind of want to stay away from that?
My favorite story about this actually goes back to the mid-2000s when Gmail came online, and they by far had the cheapest options in terms of like space that you could have for your mailbox. So shortly after Gmail came online first, where they were giving away on the order of gigabytes of free storage when everyone else was giving away on the order of megabytes of free storage, somebody created a Gmail FS, a file system that lets you use Gmail as your file backup. That's the story I tell people who ask me this question, including here at Blockstack. If you create something that's akin or approachable to free storage, someone's going to turn it into their backup solution.
That's so funny.
Generally speaking, it's a bad idea. Don't do that unless you intend to replace Amazon.
You're telling me that the gigabyte blocks are not the solution to scaling?
Of course not. People will just use it to back up their files.
Where do you think that, where is the optimal trade-off, or is it kind of unknowable? I mean, at what point does the externality of free storage become intolerable for the network?
So there's an excellent paper from IC3 about this where they measure, it's not under storage, but they measure quote unquote decentralization for some paper defined version of decentralization. And they figure out how big can blocks be if your goal is to ensure that many peers in many different parts of the internet are able to keep up with the blockchain. If that is your goal, then your block size is, as the time of they measured it, on the order of 4 megabytes or so.
So not that different from where Bitcoin is today.
Yeah, that's right. The limiting factor there isn't even how big can you make a hard drive. The limiting factor there is how fast can you send the data to all corners of the internet, and also how fast can each of these nodes, which are varying degrees of age, how fast can they process those blocks? In particular, if you look at the design of successful blockchains, the rate at which blocks propagate and can be validated is necessarily a lot smaller than the time between blocks, because you have to give the rest of the network a chance to catch up if you want to thwart certain types of attacks like selfish mining or block withholding and other things like that.
I guess the Bitcoin SV case study recently where they kept orphaning blocks because they're making them too big is a cool sort of real world example of these cautionary tales that we told ourselves for years and years. And then finally, we got some empirical evidence. Yeah, in fact, you can't make them too big or the network won't function very well.
Well, if I were one of those IC3 researchers, I'd be screaming, "I told you so," from the highest mountain I could climb to.
Yeah. So Blockstack uses Bitcoin as the anchor layer, is that right?
Yeah, that's the case for now.
Jude, you want to go into directionally where we're headed?
Sure. So right now we're building the second generation Stax blockchain, where we have our wholly separate block structure, wire format, validation rules and such, but the blocks themselves are anchored to the Bitcoin chain via a single transaction. So one Bitcoin transaction stands in for 2 megabytes or so of block data. So our bandwidth isn't going to be too different from Bitcoin's. It's just that this gives us a greater degree of separation from some of the less fortunate design consequences of Bitcoin. In particular, our system will offer much better support for smart contracts and will also offer the ability to relay micro blocks in a streaming fashion as opposed to a batch fashion. That, we think, will facilitate certain useful properties of certain types of decentralized applications. But fundamentally, though, not much has changed from a bandwidth and space perspective. The block time will be on the order of 10 minutes like with Bitcoin, and the amount of space you're getting per block isn't going to be that much bigger. However, at Blockstack, we design applications so that almost all application activity happens off-chain. The only thing you really need the blockchain for is just to facilitate user-to-user discovery. So how can I discover where your data is kept, or how can I bootstrap a connection to your browser so we can start using the app completely off-chain? So our philosophy is don't use the blockchain at all if you can help it.
Do you have independent kind of validation on the Stax chain, or is it all dependent on Bitcoin's own security?
So we just use the hash power and the difficulty of reorganization from Bitcoin. So the Stax blockchain will be just as hard to reorg and just as hard to attack in that fashion. We use a novel consensus protocol called proof of burn, where instead of destroying electricity to produce tokens the way that a proof of work system works, you destroy an existing cryptocurrency to produce Stax blocks. So it's like proof of work by proxy. There's no additional electricity expenditure, but you still have the same types of game mechanics at play here, as long as Stax chain itself doesn't economically overtake Bitcoin.
That's fascinating. I think this is in a class of a new set of sort of blockchains that are anchoring themselves in some way to Bitcoin, Verablock being another easy example. And I think there's this kind of new acknowledgement that Bitcoin security can be inherited in a variety of kind of third-party applications, and it's worth using it.
Yeah, completely agree.
And it took a long time for this to sink in, as you know. I think the 2012 through 2016 era was one where people wanted to launch their own independent versions of Bitcoin with slightly different like tweaks and trade-offs. And now there's this acknowledgement that, well, we might as well rely at least in part on the you know, overwhelming security of Bitcoin.
Yeah, I think that's part of it. I also think a huge part of that is Ethereum lowered the barrier to entry for doing basically your own altcoin. You don't have to worry about setting up your own peer network anymore. You just create an ERC-20 and call it a day.
Yeah, for good or for bad, though. Right.
Yeah, more or less.
So, Nick, I failed to ask this in the beginning, but how did you get into Bitcoin and cryptocurrency in general?
Sure. I was a Redditor. I was really big on Reddit from kind of 2010 onwards. And, you know, back in the day, Reddit was more of a Slashdot style forum than the like highly mainstream website it is today. And so Bitcoin was like fairly prominent on all the tech subreddits and then obviously the Bitcoin subreddit. And so I just sort of fell into it that way. And I just loved the idea of like P2P tipping I know that's not the biggest idea in the world, but like permissionless tipping, I found to be extremely cool. And when actually Dogecoin was created, I thought that was absolutely hilarious at the time, just looking back. Although right now it's like a little cringeworthy how long the joke has gone on. And I just love the like the sense of community that appeared around Dogecoin in particular. If you recall, like the Jamaican bobsled team, and they sponsored a NASCAR vehicle. This was in like 2013, 14. I even mined some like on my laptop. I was at university. It was just like a very entertaining and very like innocent period. You know, it wasn't like as cynical and high stakes as crypto is today. So yeah, I was just a, you know, kind of a grassroots Bitcoiner, and also dabbled in some of the altcoins. Professionally, I got into crypto after I did a master's in finance, where I sought to actually learn valuation techniques, or to borrow techniques used in equity valuation and apply them to crypto, because I thought, well, there's lots of information present on the blockchain. Can we derive the equivalent of like a price to earnings ratio for a cryptocurrency? And this proved to be, I think, an impossible task, because, you know, as far as I know, there are no good valuation techniques for cryptocurrencies. But this is something I became obsessed with in like 2016. And coming out of school, I got connected to the folks at Fidelity, and they were super progressive about Bitcoin. They had a huge contingent of staff focusing on Bitcoin, which I thought was amazing for a large asset manager. So I joined there. They actually had a balance sheet crypto fund. So I joined it as their analyst, you know, to cover like cryptocurrencies and blockchains in a long form way, similar to an equity research role. And like, this was an absolutely dream job to me, and something that I would have never believed would be a real job, you know, just a few years prior. And after doing that for some time, myself and Matt Walsh ended up spinning out and starting Castle Island Ventures, because we really believed that, you know, we could help drive this industry forward by backing entrepreneurs building on top of blockchains, you know, public blockchains. So we don't really focus on enterprise blockchains or any of that. We are completely steadfast in our belief that public blockchains are this new general purpose infrastructure that is permissionless. And, you know, we think it'll be the backdrop for this like payments and settlements revolution. And we're pretty sincere about that. So we've been at it for almost a year now.
Got it. I want to circle back to that, but aside from finance, you also studied philosophy, right?
When I was an undergrad, yeah.
So how do you think that's sort of shaped your view on this space?
Yeah, I wish there were more like people with backgrounds in philosophy and crypto. It certainly helped me structure my thinking. And the stuff that I'm known for writing is probably more on the kind of the navel-gazing side. One concept that I think about a lot and directly borrows things that I learned in my philosophy degree is the sort of ontology of blockchains. So that's just a fancy word to say the study of existence, essentially. Because, you know, when Satoshi created Bitcoin in 2009, he didn't really spare a lot of thought to how it would retain its identity over time. And, you know, what would constitute Bitcoin? By definition, it's like this leaderless project. And there's no like trademark or anything. Or foundation. By design, it's meant to be decentralized in its leadership. And so there can be no controlling organization. Bitcoin in particular seeks that radical political decentralization. So then you have this paradox where it's difficult for it to retain an identity over time, and also to malleate slightly if it has to evolve in any particular direction, which it does, you know, out of practicality, it has to change occasionally. So how can it retain its like decentralized leaderless property while changing and remaining true to like its original nature? This is why we have these like incredibly pitched battles about what the essence and the soul of Bitcoin is, and like BSV is the true Bitcoin or BCH. This is like an inescapable problem. So I don't know if there's a great answer, but I think it's an absolutely fascinating topic. I mean, we have this like this virtual organism that hires miners and pays them billions of dollars a year to provide energy inputs into the network. And it matches a two-sided market with people that want to buy spaces and, you know, spots in the ledger. And Bitcoin is just this decentralized creature which matches up those two sides to me, like pondering those issues of like, how does Bitcoin's identity stay consistent with its values over time while changing? I think that's like a very important question. And I don't think there's any easy answers like, oh, like just trademark Bitcoin and then whatever entity is in control of the trademark decides what Bitcoin is. You know, people are always looking for easy answers on these questions, and I don't think they exist, but I think they're worth thinking about at least.
Yeah. Circling back to your VC and investing in public blockchains, kind of outside of Bitcoin, which has a fairly narrowly defined scope, let's say, what other sort of public blockchains interest you?
Yeah, so we're not that ideological as far as our firm is concerned. The main way we kind of weight our attention is just by, you know, what level of protocol risk are you undertaking when you build on top of a blockchain? I think that's something that entrepreneurs should be aware of. And if you're building on one of the top blockchains in terms of usage and stability and security, then, you know, you're not at risk as much. But if you're building on the like 20th most popular smart contract platform, there's like a very real chance that the main developers like give up at a certain point, and then you have been marooned on this obsolete chain. So that's kind of part of our justification for our focus on the most robust and secure blockchains. You know, I think in that respect, Bitcoin, you know, is still, it may fail for sure, but we at least understand it the best. Ethereum 2 is like entering the stage of maturation. We'll see what happens with Ethereum 2.0. If it were up to me, I think Ethereum would stay on its current track, remain on proof of work, so as to not obsolete all the existing contracts. Yeah, that's kind of our view, because when you're betting on a startup that's building on a blockchain, you're betting not only on the startup's ability to execute, but also you're betting on the security of the blockchain they're building on. And every startup says, well, you know, we can build ourselves to be agnostic. But I think in practice, you kind of have to specialize a little bit. So that's why we have a bit of a bias or a preference for just the more popular chains.
It's funny you say that. A while back, Muneeb Bar, the co-founder of Blockstack, used to like to tell this story whenever he gave talks, because before Blockstack was built on Bitcoin, it was built on Namecoin.
Oh, that's so funny.
Well, the story he likes to tell is along the same lines. He and the other co-founder, Ryan Shea, had spent some time trying to get the system to work well with Namecoin, and also by extension to get Namecoin itself to behave well by itself. It had problems where it would crash periodically and other sorts of things like that. But the biggest indicator to him that you really do have to be on the strongest chain was he had discovered that one of the Bitcoin mining pools that merge mined Namecoin had, in essence, over 60% of the entire hash power of Namecoin. So that single miner was controlling it. But the scary thing to him wasn't that this was just happening, but that it was happening for months and nobody noticed or cared. Whereas in the same year, Ghash, I think it was, Ghash.io reached barely over 50% of Bitcoin's hash power, and everyone lost their minds over it for days and days. Like, that right there is a very important security property of your blockchain. You want that kind of vigilance in your platform, because now you have a bunch of people who will completely lose their minds online and make sure that whoever is violating the trust of the protocol is suitably punished, which is what happened with Ghash.
This reminds me of a pretty entertaining episode in the history of Coinmetrics, which is my startup, where we were doing really routine diligence on all of the top 50 or so chains, initially just to determine what their supply was, you know. And oftentimes developers will say, well, you know, we have a 4-year vesting period on our own treasury funds. But then you look at the chain and you see that it's not encumbered, or that the smart contract accelerates the vesting for some reason. There's often a discrepancy between what is promised in like a white paper in terms of just something very simple like supply, and then the reality when you like inspect the ledger. And we actually found a pretty fun irregularity in this fork of Bitcoin and a fork of Z Classic called Bitcoin Private, where they had this UTXO import, where they imported all the Bitcoin UTXOs. And during that process, someone managed to inflate the total supply by 10%. so by like 2 million coins, and nobody noticed. Not the developers, not the community, you know, none of the block explorers, CoinMarketCap didn't notice. And this was this like exploit, or maybe it was deliberate by the developers, I don't know, went unnoticed for months and months until we picked it up in like a routine audit. And it does kind of go to show that even something absolutely critical like the number of units in existence, it almost never goes vetted or challenged by some of these smaller communities, which is why you have the safety if you're on one of the bigger chains.
Yeah, for sure. It's almost like Linus's law taken to its ultimate extreme. Given enough eyeballs, all bugs are shallow.
Although we still get bugs on Bitcoin. You know, we had the critical one like just recently.
This is true. I predict that if such a bug like that got exploited, the reaction and backlash would be so severe that miners would probably end up unwinding the chain on which the bug was exploited and then replaying the transactions that were not dependent on that bug being exploited in order to mitigate it before developers would even have a chance to patch it, just like how they did in 2013 with the integer overflow.
Yeah, they did. Yeah. I mean, it's kind of, you hesitate to make that part of Bitcoin's security model, you know, that there would be this like subjective exercise to excise like obviously fraudulent transactions. But I mean, in practice, I agree. I think that probably would be the case.
Well, Bitcoin is more than just software, though. Bitcoin is fundamentally a social contract that's realized as a software artifact. You could say that, yes, it's a shame that it can't automatically correct itself. But you could also say that, to use your word here, ontologically speaking, Bitcoin is no longer Bitcoin if it suddenly goes from 21 million coins to 2 to the 64th power minus 1 coins.
Yeah. I mean, I definitely agree with you. So I think that the social contract or the core values supersede, you know, the reality of the chain. And if there's a dispute, we should defer to what the implicit contract says. Then you get into questions of like, well, who enforces the contract and, you know, who's in charge of it and can it change over time? And what if we all collectively agree that the 21 million cap can be busted and so on? Yeah, there are difficult questions that we have to face, I think, if we acknowledge that reality.
This is true. I guess maybe the first hint as to a solution to that would be to quote Satoshi himself or herself or themselves, unclear which one it was, people vote with their CPUs. They'll mine on whatever chain they believe follows the quote-unquote proper definition of Bitcoin and call that Bitcoin.
Yeah, it does imply that Bitcoin itself can change dramatically, though, which I guess is fair. I mean, it has changed quite a bit in the last 10 years.
Yeah, and people have the power to fork if they feel like they can do it better or do it differently.
Yeah, the interesting thing about forks is there are very few cases where the developers didn't bless the chain that ended up winning. You know, like if you look at Ethereum Classic, the Ethereum developers, you know, specifically selected the Ethereum chain, you know, and said, well, the Ethereum Classic chain is not the one. You know, the majority of the Bitcoin developers in the Bitcoin Cash fork were like, you know, Bitcoin Core, so to speak, that's the one. And I think the only dissenting case here would be actually the history of Monero. If you have looked into it, there was a bit of a coup where the dominant developer was kind of jettisoned from the project, and then the kind of current Monero leadership took over. But in every other case, the incumbent developers have kind of selected a side of the fork, and that one, in fact, was the winner.
Having come from an open source background prior to joining Blockstack, that doesn't surprise me in the slightest. That's very similar to how it works in the open source world, too. The incumbent developers, in the event of a project fork, usually end up winning. Unless it's a case like Monero, where it's one person who's being a jackass, and that person gets jettisoned.
I think that's exactly what happened. I would say there's the disanalogy there is that, like, in just like conventional open source, like the monetary stakes are lower. If you have a small monetary network, that's deadly because I guess because you've got like these Metcalfe law style effects where if there is virtually no one using the network, then like really the like native currency is not going to be worth a lot. So if you lose, like you really lose. Whereas I think, you know, I'm not a huge like open source guy, but I think you can fork kind of costlessly maybe in like conventional open source.
I definitely think that there is a lot less inertia to forking in non-monetary open source projects. But I also think that people get very emotionally invested in whichever fork they prefer, whether or not there's a crypto token at all. And we've seen this before. Like back in the 90s, there was a competing fork of GCC called, I think it was ECGS or something, that was taking a very different approach to the compiler architecture. They eventually merged back together, but the fact that people can dedicate their spare man hours towards this for even years at a time indicates that it's more than money that motivates these people.
Oh, of course. Yeah, for sure. And I think that was a kind of a myth that was very pervasive in 2017 in crypto, which was developers are mercenaries and we need to fund them exclusively with like inflation, like built-in inflation from the protocol. I always felt like, well, you know, like something like Bitcoin can succeed without that, because people will work on it even in the absence of like explicit protocol funded compensation.
Oh yeah, like protocol funded compensation definitely can help, but it's certainly not the only thing that drives it.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say in some cases it's a risk. Like you look at the Zcash situation where it was very much founded on this element of baked in compensation for the devs. And then you get a situation where they become used to it and there's no ability to fire like the initial people who are allocated that, or to really replace you know, the beneficiaries of the seniorage. And so then you get this kind of like inertia, like you get a set of individuals that are like very used to receiving that. And even if it were better to reappropriate those funds and use them for something else, in practice, you can't really do that at all. So I think there certainly are risks. And we saw this, like there are some proposals to like alter the nature of the development fund, and those got shot down like really aggressively and with extreme hostility. So there, it's like very tricky once you define like a group of entities that are the beneficiaries of the kind of protocol inflation.
It's a very good point. Patrick, do you want to contrast this situation with our app mining program, which I don't really think has that same kind of problem?
What specifically?
One thing like that strikes me about the risk of a system like Zcash's founder's reward is that you basically can get these developers who are benefiting from the founder's reward to grow complacent because they're getting paid either way.
I see.
Whereas in our system, you have to compete all the time to receive a fraction of the reward.
Yeah, and just to take a step back, I definitely see crypto networks as things that are inherently political and things for which you want to create reliability. You want developers to be able to rely on like the platform, and you want to be very careful with the steps you take. So you want to avoid things like tragedy of the commons. You want to avoid baking in governance all on the blockchain as if it's sort of handed down by God. You want to watch where other people have made mistakes and not make those mistakes. Just kind of like setting that as the background to sort of this novel economic system we're experimenting right now with called app mining. And in app mining, what happens is every month, a set of applications have a wallet attached to them, and presumably an application team that's fervently working on these applications are dispersed a set of funds on a distribution curve that awards the highest amount to the sort of highest ranked app for that month and sort of the lowest amount to the lowest ranked app of that month. This is how the system operates currently. You know, in the early days, Blockstack PBC, along with the Blockstack community, are working together to experiment with what it means to be lowly ranked.
That's what I was going to ask you, because I mean, cognizant of our earlier comments on the inherent gameability of rankings in a crypto concept, I was going to ask you how you derive that.
In our initial kind of version of app mining as it began essentially in December of 2018, there were a lot of subjective scoring. There was like a lot of voting from Blockstack community, ProcTank community, and we actually learned a lot of really valuable lessons in terms of making sure developers are happy with the game they're in. Subjectivity is something that is not very desirable unless you have massive numbers of people voting on things with well-aligned incentives, which are very hard to calibrate. You're pretty much either under-incentivizing or over-incentivizing subjectivity at any given time. So what we've done is we really move this sort of game toward a much more objective measurement of an app's quality, where it is in its state today, which is not where it's going to be in its state 5 months from now, I'd even presume, is you have an awareness score that is factored in to an aggregation algorithm. Along with that, you have a user experience score, which is a randomly, so it's a, like out of 2 million people, you get 10 people reviewing your app based on those people's familiarity with apps that are sort of similar in nature. So they kind of like self-select in that regard. And we're still kind of buffing out some of the things in regards to, you know, novelty of apps and how you sort of rank those things. So this is not a perfect system, but it's like directionally pretty damn good.
What's the aggregate value of rewards being paid out through app mining?
Yeah, great question. So right now the aggregate value is $100,000 and we're paying right now in Bitcoin.
Per month or?
Per month.
It's pretty substantial.
It's pretty substantial. And we're kind of in this period with the SEC where we've filed a Reg A, and we'll get to that topic in a bit. But subject to SEC approval of the Reg A filing and the ability to sort of issue tokens for app mining, what we would do is we would actually significantly increase that amount to a point that makes the game even more competitive. So the idea there is the number is kind of being dialed in, but the eventual number under the sort of Reg A plus, you know, sort of regime would be about $1 million of the Stacks tokens per month.
And that would come from your own treasury, presumably?
Yeah, so essentially Blockstack is issuing this during the Reg A period. And just to say up front, at the time of this recording, we're still anticipating a decision from the SEC, so I can't comment fully on everything.
Yeah.
But we see a novel path to decentralization that includes embracing investor protections and transparency and things like that. Under the Reg A sort of qualification, the idea is to give out roughly $12 million worth of tokens under that time period and under that qualification. Past that, there's worlds in which the amount that's distributed is sort of commensurate to the value of the token itself or can potentially increase or decrease over time.
Well, I have to say, so I wrote my master's thesis on investor protections in token raises, and I was grading them on transparency, on governance rights, you know, what the token was giving you and like what disclosures were the teams providing. And this was, I was writing this in late 2016, early 2017. So there hadn't been many ICOs or token raises. And at the time I was flabbergasted by the fact that there were no disclosures essentially. And that really soured me on ICOs basically, you know, in perpetuity. And I don't regret that stance. And I have to say, I think your SEC filing was the first disclosure that I ever read, which was like, well, this is sufficient. You know, you finally met an appropriate standard of disclosure here for kind of a token raise, which is in the interest of investors. I was astonished that this hadn't been done before. I think on behalf of the industry, you know, thank you guys for kind of establishing a reasonable standard here. I mean, I appreciate that it's also probably a very expensive and cumbersome way to raise.
To the first part of what you said, very much appreciate it. It definitely was like kind of like a long road and the kimono was open, you know. People can see kind of what we're working with behind the scenes.
Yeah, the people will always use your transparency against you. That's the other thing. The incentive in this industry is always to be as opaque as possible.
Yeah. We believe in transparency, as I mentioned earlier, and we believe in investor protections, you know, especially in the sort of fledgling state of a blockchain network. And the comment of amount of, you know, work and effort and capital required to get to this point, yeah, it was definitely a lot of work. It was many months and diverted resources toward this to sort of set the precedent. But the reality is, there's two things. As time goes on, we think that kind of like reaching these standards of disclosure and being accepted under different regulatory qualifications, it'll be easier and easier over time,
yeah,
especially for sort of initial projects. And secondly, we think a lot of projects are just going to utilize a lot of the learnings and work that we have already done. In order to sort of expedite the process, they can hop on our backs and ride part of the way there.
On the app mining question, do those tokens, are they granted to the developers of these apps or to users?
So that's a great question. So they're granted directly to the developers. So presumably developers are really kind of the lifeblood of a network. If your token is all about speculation and you really have no developer activity, and you're not producing anything useful on a long enough timeline, the sort of value of the network and the reason to participate may in fact go to zero. Our goal is really to make developers as happy as possible while also being as fair as possible. Developers who add value to the network, we believe, deserve to be compensated for their value add to the network if you can quantify it in a way that's acceptable. There are already developers that are quitting their full-time jobs, getting paid six-figure salaries to work on Blockstack apps through app mining.
where would you situate Blockstack in terms of the most vibrant dApp platforms, call them? Where would you place it in the kind of existing ranking?
Sure. So we have nearly 100 apps already, and we've grown the number of apps 100% quarter over quarter for the past few quarters. In terms of useful apps that people, you know, kind of want to use on a daily basis that aren't betting apps or prediction markets, things like that, like apps that you would use in a practical setting on a daily basis, let's say a personal version of Google Drive, so that when I create a document, I can send it to my friend and there's no third parties in between. I think we're number one. And what's happening is we developed this very sort of reliable platform upon which to build these sort of apps. And while we are introducing smart contracts that are better in many ways than how traditional smart contracts have been deployed, we do not take the lens in which to look at apps is through smart contracts or transactions solely. It's on like real value and utility of applications. And really for us, our mission is really in effect upgrade the internet and pull people off of the sort of porous, unsecure sort of application system of the world that they're currently operating in with, you know, Facebook and Google and name your centralized data silo du jour company, and move them to one where they own their own data and they're like a first class citizen. They own their own identity, they own their own data, they own their own friends, they own their own money. And the relationship between the developers and the users is a much more healthy one, where users are really, really retaining the kind of control that they have, and developers are there to serve them and create enterprise and business based on the preservation of those users' fundamental digital rights. In many ways, the current internet we're using today is like a bad neighborhood. And in the Blockstack world, you have locks on your doors. You can protect yourself. You can walk about freely. You have a right to own your own property. You have a right to own the things inside your house. You know, as we were saying before, not to go on too far of a diatribe, but as we were saying before, crypto networks are inherently political and have striking similarities to sort of cities and nation states in a sense. Mm-hmm. And I think that when you look at the internet we're operating on today, it really is sort of like a third world country where people don't have their own property rights, and the ability to advance into the first world in a sense is greatly inhibited. And the ability for massive innovation to actually occur at the data layer, where users own their own data and their own encrypted, private clouds, is massively stifled as well. When you have like these huge companies like Facebook and Google, essentially, like you need their permission in order to develop on them or use them. We're kind of reinstantiating like what we believe is like a natural law, and we believe that natural law is something that people have not woken up to yet, which is they have the right to own things online, and as a function of that right, the right to security and privacy. And so like some of the things that I know you're interested in from that philosophical lens and from a geopolitical lens really do apply to the sort of crypto networks. It's like, how do we want to build this new society? What rules are standard? What things can we change? What things can we not change ever? What things can be voted in and at what level? So there's all these sort of unsolved problems that we want to take a very measured and sure-footed approach to solving, lest we create things like tragedy of the commons or issues with the underlying infrastructure, essentially.
It's a very stirring comment, and I totally agree.
I aim to stir.
It's so funny to me that we, so much of the time in crypto, we recreate these messy and ugly human institutions, you know, like voting-driven governance, which becomes cartelized, in short order or corrupted. And we don't pay enough attention to creating durable digital constitutions that are actually well thought out and work well and can last. So I think it's a really urgent priority, and it totally overlooked half the time in favor of basically expediency.
Totally. I probably say this too much, but the backgrounds of the folks who are designing the what are in effect going to be new pillars of society for us to live and do business on and communicate with our friends and family on are being designed not but necessarily by political theorists or game theorists, but a lot of the time by computer scientists with fully baked ideas about how the system sort of works as this big machine. Where in fact, I think this is like a faulty sort of premise to kind of usher out, you know, like a crypto network and something that could be way more impactful. Like it almost doesn't give the respect and quality of thought that these sort of things deserve.
Totally. One thing I critique a lot is this modeling of humans is like, I call it rationality vending machines, where designers of crypto networks will often model humans as like, if you insert a token of value, they'll spit out rational decision-making. And then they just assume that this is the case. So like, very simple example would be Augur, for instance, where it's assumed that people will behave honestly because like so-and-so, and they have like a financial incentive to do so. But in practice, you just like get all kinds of edge cases and difficulties and, you know, different incentives entirely. And I think this like humans as rationality vending machines has really like corrupted a lot of these networks, and there's been like sort of insufficient care given to the difficulties governing them. And maybe now there's only like this emergence of thought that we can't exactly rely on the same like meat-based institutions.
Definitely. Jude, you want to chime in on any of this?
Yeah, sure. I totally agree with what you had said there, Patrick. A lot of these quote-unquote governance systems are designed by people who are maybe qualified to write software, but certainly not qualified to design political systems. I was just shaking my head and muttering under my breath there when you said that bit about computer scientists designing governance. I was thinking to myself, yeah, God help us all. It's so true. Like, I do not trust myself to write a governance system in software that in any way, shape, or form reflects the way people behave.
I don't know who we would trust, though, to design a I don't know if there's a qualification that means, like, you are the guy that can write a constitution for a digital republic.
I would say that no one is. I personally do not relish the idea of being the subject of a tyrannical program, which is essentially what these people are striving to do. It's like, let's just go build Skynet and have it govern us. And to that, I say no. No, thank you.
So you would, Jude, you'd prefer that there's always a way to kind of veto these systems or shut them down?
Absolutely. Software is an artifact of human behavior. It's not an overlord. Like, we have failed as a species if we manage to build machines that enslave us.
Isn't that, to some degree, Bitcoin is an unturn-offable machine?
Oh, rest assured, Bitcoin can very easily be turned off by the powers that be. It's just that they're making money by not turning it off.
I suppose. Yeah.
Renders Nick commentless. That was great.
I like to think of it as unturn-offable. That's more comforting.
I mean, all China has to do is kidnap all the miners' families and say, stop mining or else. And then it stops.
Then we get a difficulty adjustment, and like the two Western miners will keep it going.
I mean, it could be a coordinated state action. Like, it's not even, Bitcoin is like beneath the notice of these people. Like, Bitcoin may be big to us, but way bigger are things like international terrorist groups laundering money, which is what they spend their time going after.
Yeah, you know, what surprises me is that the laundering scandals haven't really hit crypto yet. It does seem that they are going to in relatively short order, though. And then the spotlight will be on us.
Yeah, for sure. And we can largely credit exchanges for more or less not doing business with terrorists, keeping that at bay.
Well, maybe it's because terrorists haven't been able to derive value from crypto for the most part. But I, from my experience, exchanges are very lax with their controls.
Well, we might see that change. And I don't look forward to the day where I have to explain to the law enforcement powers that be why I designed a mechanism that facilitates terrorism.
I think it's inevitable. Well, I mean, not for you personally. I think it's inevitable that, you know, undesirables are going to use these things, and we almost have to make our peace with that.
Oh, yeah, I understand that. And I totally agree that it's an inevitability. I'm merely commenting on the unturn-offableness of these systems.
So, Nick, both Jude and I actually have to hop off now. But for the listeners listening, folks who follow you on Twitter, I like to ask this every once in a while, like, what sort of books or resources would you recommend folks read, essentially? Like, I think everyone kind of has a few books that they hold close to their heart that they feel has given them some mental models that can help them kind of look at this world in a new and interesting and useful way.
In just for the crypto context or just in general?
The kind of anchor here is crypto, so I would say maybe crypto.
Yeah, so for me, starting from the pragmatic, the books that helped me were the Princeton textbook on cryptocurrencies. I actually found that to be great. The Arvind Narayanan textbook, And I also read this book, Applied Cryptography, and half of it I didn't understand. But the parts that I did understand helped me with elliptic curves and RSA and hash functions. And that was very useful for me because I don't like to understand systems that there are parts of them that I really don't get. So I did, like, I don't think everyone needs like a cryptography education to like use Bitcoin or something. But for me personally, I felt that I had to learn. But more generally, like, there's this really good book called The Information, which is about information theory, which I found to be like absolutely revelatory in explaining concepts like entropy, which had escaped me before.
I found that one to kind of jump around.
It did, for sure, but I didn't have any grounding in the subject matter, so it was very useful for me. I do really like Taleb's canon, like especially as it relates to trading and investment. So virtually everything by Nassim Taleb. I know that's such a hackneyed answer, but I would say in particular, like his first book, Fooled by Randomness, when he wasn't quite as like accomplished and like full of himself as he became later in his career, is full like of a lot of really solid wisdom, especially as it relates to like financial markets. And like one of my favorite passages from that book describes like traders that overfit their strategies to like the recent market history are always the most successful, apparently successful traders at any given point in time. Like, so right now, if you like a trader that had gone like leveraged long on US equity for the last 10 years would be insanely successful. They'd have a great track record, but market conditions change and they will punish people that overfit their strategies to like recent market history. Basically, it's a parable about like jealousy. So don't be jealous or envious of your peer who appears to be doing extremely well from a trading perspective, because it may be that they just heaped on a ton of leverage or like overfitted a strategy. So like, don't be jealous of like your buddy who just bought the trashiest ICOs in like 2017, because as we all know, market conditions can change really abruptly. So I've always found that to be like a really interesting parable. And it's like, that book is like full of that stuff. So I just love it.
Yeah. Lamborghinis are pretty tacky anyways. So
who needs them? Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Cool. Well, Nick, you know, it's my first time talking to you. I just want to say thanks so much for hopping on. And this is a really interesting conversation. I feel like it'd be great to have you on again and talk more. I feel like you have like a wealth of information and we've kind of just scratched the surface.
I appreciate that. Well, we'll leave your listeners some time to digest this one and then we'll do it again.
For sure. All right. Take care.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
This has been the Stacks Podcast. You can follow Nick Carter on Twitter at @Nick_Carter. Jude Nelson is @JudeCNelson. Patrick Stanley is @PatrickWStanley. And I'm @ZachValente. If you like this episode, please consider leaving a rating or review for the show wherever you listen to podcasts. To learn more about building decentralized apps, please visit blockstack.org. The music in this episode is by Andrew Apple Pie. Check out andrewapplepie.com for more. Until next time, thank you for listening.